bloody contour blades. All the way to the airport and back, she had known there was something she had forgotten. For little things are as dreadful to her as big things these days. Now I will buy cheese for lunch. Now I will buy bread to go with the cheese. She closes her eyes and takes another enormous breath. Did you sleep? She asks. Like the dead. Didn't you notice? Yes, I noticed. I noticed how you slipped out of bed at 2 a.m. and crept downstairs to your workroom. How you paced and stopped pacing. I heard the creak of your chair and the whisper of your felt-tipped pen as you began to write. Who to? In what voice? Which one? A boom of music drowns the sound of his shaving. He has switched on his clever radio for the BBC World News. Magnus knows the time to the minute, all through the day and night. If he looks at his watch, it is only to confirm the schedules in his brain. She listens numbly to a recitation of events no one is able to control. A bomb has gone off in Beirut. A town has been wiped out in El Salvador. The pound has fallen, or risen. The Russians are out of the next Olympics, or into them, after all. Magnus follows politics like a gambler who is too wise to bet. The noise grows steadily louder as Magnus carries the radio upstairs. Slop, slop. Naked except for his sandals. He bends over her, and she smells his shaving soap and the flat Greek cigarettes he has taken to smoking while he writes. Still sleepy? A bit. How's Rat? Mary has been tending a half-eviscerated rat she found in the garden. It is lying in a straw box in Tom's room. I haven't looked, she says. He kisses her close to the ear, an explosion, and starts to fondle her breast, as a sign to her to take him. But she grunts an awkward, later, and rolls over. She hears him slop to the wardrobe. She hears the old door resist and jolt open. If he chooses shorts, he's going for a walk. If he chooses jeans, he's going into town to drink with the deadbeats. Colonel, call me Parky Parker, with my Greek fancy boy and my psyllium dog that I hold on the lead like a teapot. Elsie and Ethel, retired dyke schoolteachers from Liverpool. Jock somebody. I've a wee business in Dundee. Magnus pulls out a shirt and slips it on. She hears him fastening his shorts. Where are you going? She says. For a walk. Wait for me, I'll come with you. You can tell me about it. Who was this speaking out of her suddenly? This mature, straight-to-the-point woman. Magnus is as surprised as she is. About what, for heaven's sake? Whatever it is that's worrying you, darling, I don't mind. Just tell me whatever it is. So that I don't have to... Don't have to what? Bottle it up. Look away. Nonsense, everything's fine. We're just both a bit blue without Tom. He goes to her and lays her back on the pillow, as if she were an invalid. You sleep it off. I'll walk it off. See you at the taverna, around 3. Only Magnus can make Kyria Katina's front door close so softly. Suddenly Mary is strong. His departure has released her. Breathe. She goes to the north window. Everything planned. She has done these things before and remembers now that she is good at them, often steadier than the men. In Berlin, when Jack needed a spare girl, Mary had kept watch, gulled room keys out of the concierges, replaced stolen documents in dangerous desks, driven scared Joes to safe flats. I knew the game better than I realized, she thought. Jack used to praise my coolness and my sharp eye. From the window she sees a new tarmac road winding into the hills. Sometimes he goes that way, but not today. Opening the window, she leans out as if savouring the place and mourning. That witch Katina has milked her goats early. That means she's gone to market. Only one fleeting glance does Mary allow herself towards the dried-up riverbed, where, in the shadow of the stone footbridge, the same two boys are tinkering with their German-registered motorbike. If they had appeared outside the house in Vienna like this, Mary would have been onto Magnus in an instant, phoned him if need be at the embassy. Looks like the angels are flying rather low today, she'd have said. And Magnus would have done whatever he did, alerted the diplomatic patrol, sent his people down to check them out. But now, in their separated lives, it is as if they have agreed between them that angels, even suspected ones, are not to be remarked upon. His workroom is on the ground floor. He does not lock the door on her. But there is an ethic between them that she does not enter except at his specific beckoning. She turns the handle and steps inside. The shutters are closed, but they do not cover the upper window panes, and there is light for her to see by. Tread heavily, she tells herself, remembering her training. If you have to make a noise, make a bold one. The room is sparse, which is what Magnus likes. A desk, a chair, a single bed to crash on between bursts of creative matrix writing. She pulls back the chair and sends a bottle of vodka skidding. The desk is covered with books and papers, but she touches nothing. His old buckram-bound copy of Simplicissimus occupies pride of place, as usual. His mascot is something. It is a source of permanent offence to Mary that he will never let her bind it. "Because I like it the way it is," he says stubbornly. "That's how it was given to me." By some woman, no doubt. "For Sir Magnus, who will never be my enemy," reads the inscription in German. Screw her, and screw fancy nicknames. Brotherhood had again interrupted. "Where's it now, this book?" With difficulty and a slight resentment, Mary returned to time present. But Brotherhood insisted. "It's not in his desk downstairs. I didn't see it lying about in the drawing room either. It's not in the bedroom or in Tom's room. Where is it?"
"I told you," she said. "He takes it everywhere."
"You didn't, but thank you," Brotherhood retorted. She is wearing a pair of cotton gloves against sweat and grime marks.
He'll use a trick. He does those things instinctively.
His old briefcase lies on the floor, wide open, but she doesn't touch that either. Other books are strewn like paperweights to hold down the manuscript, and seemingly at random. She reads a title. It is in German. Freedom and Conscience, by someone she has never heard of. Beside it, a copy of Maddox Ford's Good Soldier, which Magnus reads incessantly these days. It has become his Bible. Beside this again, an old photograph album. Gently she lifts the unfamiliar cover, and without moving it, turns a few pages. Magnus, aged 8 in football gear, a team group. Magnus, aged 5 in alpine setting, holding a toboggan. Magnus at Tom's age, already with his over-willing smile, inviting you in, but not expecting to be invited. Magnus on honeymoon with Belinda, neither of them looking more than about 12 years old. She has not seen these photographs before. Letting the cover fall, Mary steps back and again surveys the arrangement on the desk. As she does so, his bit of tradecraft becomes apparent to her. Each of the three books, lying seemingly haphazardly across the papers, is aligned to the point of the paper scissors at their center. Going to the kitchen, Mary grabs the tablecloth, comes back and lays it on the floor beside the desk, then measures the distances between each object on the desk with her gloved hand. As gently as if she is lifting bandages from a wound, she lays them in the same pattern on the tablecloth. The papers on the desk now lie free for her inspection. She has not reckoned with so much dust. Just by crossing the floor, she has set up clouds of it. "I'm a tomb robber," she thinks, as the dust burns her throat. She is gazing at a wad of handwritten manuscript. The top page is dark with crossings out. She picks up the wad, leaving everything else lying. She takes it to the little bed, sits down. At Plush, when she was a girl, they had called it Kim's Game, and played it every New Year's Eve, along with acting games, and murder, and reels. At the training house, when she was supposed to be adult, they called it Observation, and played it round the sleepy villages of Dedham, Manningtree, and Bergholt. Who's had their door painted this week? Pruned their roses? Bought a new car? How many bottles of milk did number 18 have on its doorstep? But wherever they play it, Mary always comes top by miles. She is cursed with a snapshot memory from which very little ever goes away. "Bits of novel," she told Brotherhood,
all beginnings. A dozen chapter ones, some typed and some in longhand, all stiff with crossings out. Mostly they told about the orphan childhood of a boy called Ben. Doodles, drawings of an arm stretched out to steal, a woman's crotch. Notes to himself, all abusive. Sentimental crap. Rewrite or destroy. You've missed the curse we pass from man to child. One day a Wentworth will get us all. A pink folder marked random passages. Ben gives himself up to the authorities. Ben discovers there is another, real secret service and joins it in the nick of time. A blue folder marked final scenes. Several of them addressed to Poppy. Dear bloody Poppy. A sheet of cartridge paper stolen from her sketch block, on which Magnus has drawn a pattern of linked think bubbles to form a flowchart of his ideas, exactly as Tom is taught to prepare his essays at school. Bubble. If all nature abhors a vacuum, how does a vacuum feel about all nature? Bubble. Duplicity is when you please one person at the expense of another. Bubble. We are patriots because we are afraid to be cosmopolitan. Cosmopolitan because we are afraid to be patriots. There was a tapping at the door, but Brotherhood shook his head at Georgie, telling her to ignore it. It wasn't his true writing, Mary said. It was all spiky. It ran for a while, then seized up. It seemed to hurt him to go on. Brotherhood didn't give a damn whom it hurt. More, he said. More. Hurry. It's me, sir, Fergus called through the door. Urgent message, sir. Very. I said wait, Brotherhood ordered. The systems of Ben's life are all collapsing, Mary continued. All his life he's been inventing versions of himself that are untrue. Now the truth is coming to get him, and he is on the run. His Wentworth is standing at the door. More, said Brotherhood, towering over her. Rick invented me. Rick is dying. What will happen when Rick drops his end of the string? Keep going. A quotation from St. Luke. I never saw him open a Bible in his life. He who is faithful in a very little is faithful also in much. And? He who is dishonest in a very little is dishonest also in much. He'd illuminated the edges of the page for hours on end, different inks. And? Wentworth was Rick's nemesis. Poppy was mine. We each spent our lives trying to put right what we'd done to them. And again. Now everyone's after me. The firm's after me. The Americans are after me. You're after me. Even poor Mary is after me, and she doesn't know you exist. You being who? Who's you in this poem? Poppy. My destiny. Dearest Poppy, best of best friends, get your bloody dogs off my doorstep.
Poppy like the flowers, Brotherhood suggested, shoving away Georgie's microphone as he knelt beside her. Like the flowers in the chimney, but singular, one Poppy.
Yes.
And Wentworth, like the plays? Sunny Wentworth in tasteful Surrey.
Yes.
Know him? Her? Anyone of that name?
No.
Or Poppy?
No.
On?
There was a chapter 8, she said. Out of the blue. No 2-7, but this chapter 8, all in his own handwriting and without a crossing out, titled Overdue Bills, whereas the chapter 1s were untitled, describing a day when Ben revolts against all his promises, slipping from third to first person and staying there, whereas the chapter 1s were he and Ben. The creditors are beating at the door, Wentworth to the fore, but Ben doesn't give a damn. I lower my head and lift my shoulders. I wade at them. I punch and flail and butt them while they smash my face in. But even with no face left, I am doing what I should have done 35 years ago. To Jack and Rick and all the mothers and fathers, for stealing my life off my plate while I watched you do it. Poppy, Jack, the rest of you, driving me into a lifetime's.
She had stopped. Iron clamps had squeezed the breath out of her. The door opened and Fergus gate crashed, a flouting of discipline for which he would surely be punished. Nigel was staring at him expressionlessly. Georgie was rolling her eyes at him, pointing at the door, and mouthing, "Get out, get out," but Fergus stood his ground. "A lifetime's what, for God's sake?" Brotherhood was shouting in her ear. She was whispering, she was screaming, she was fighting the word inside her mouth, heaving and pressing at it, but nothing came out. Brotherhood shook her, at first gently, then much harder, then very hard indeed. "Betrayal," she said. "We betray to be loyal. Betrayal is like imagining when the reality isn't good enough." He wrote that. Betrayal as hope and compensation, as the making of a better land. Betrayal as love, as a tribute to our unlived lives. On and on, these ponderous aphorisms about betrayal. Betrayal as escape, as a constructive act, as a statement of ideals, worship, as an adventure of the soul. Betrayal as travel. How can we discover new places if we never leave home? You were my promised land, Poppy. You gave my lies a reason.
And that was the very phrase she had got to in her reading, she explained, the one about Poppy and the promised land, when she turned round and saw Magnus in his shorts, standing in the open doorway to his workroom, holding a big blue envelope in one hand and the telegram in the other, smiling like the head boy of one of his schools.
"There was someone else inside him," Mary said, shocking herself. "It wasn't him."
"What the hell does that mean? You just said it was Magnus standing in the doorway. What are you getting at?"
She didn't know either. "It was something that had happened to him when he was young. Someone standing in doorways watching him. He was doing it back, somehow. I could see the recognition in his face."
"What did he say?" Nigel asked, helpfully. She had a voice for Magnus, or perhaps it was just a facial expression, empty yet impenetrable, tirelessly polite.
"Hello, old love. Catching up with the great novel, are we? Not exactly Jane Austen, I'm afraid, but some of it may be usable when I get a proper run at it."
The tablecloth was spread on the floor, his books and half his papers on it. But his smile flashed victory and relief as he held the telegram towards her. She took it from his hand and walked with it to the window in order to read it, or to distract his attention from the desk.
"It was from you, Jack," she said, "using your cover name of Victor. Addressed to Pym, care of Pembroke. Return at once, you said. All is forgiven. Committee reassembles Vienna, Monday, 10 a.m. Victor."
Taking his time, Brotherhood had turned to Fergus at last.
"What the hell do you want?" he said.
Fergus spoke the way Tom did when he had been holding back too long, waiting for the grown-ups to let him in.
"Crash message from the station clerk at the embassy, sir," he blurted. "He phoned it through in word code. I've just unbuttoned it. The station burn box is missing from the strong room."
Nigel had a funny little gesture designed to ease a charged atmosphere. He raised his beloved hands and, with the fingertips pointing loosely toward heaven, flapped them as if he were drying his nails. But Brotherhood, still kneeling at Mary's side, seemed suddenly to have been seized by lethargy. He rose slowly, then slowly passed his hand across his mouth, as if he had a bad taste on the tip of his tongue.
"Since when?" "Not known, sir. Not signed out. They've been searching for it for this last hour. They can't find it. That's all they know. There's a diplomatic courier card that goes with it. The card's disappeared, too."
Mary had not yet grasped the mood.
"The synchronization has gone wrong," she thought. "Who is in the doorway? Fergus? Or Magnus? Jack's gone deaf. Jack, who questions in salvos, has run out of ammunition.
Chancery guard says Mr. Pym called at the embassy first thing Thursday morning on his way to the airport, sir. The guard hadn't thought to mention it because he hadn't put him into his log. It was upstairs, down again, and sorry about your father, sir. But when he came down the stairs, he was carrying his heavy black pouch.
And the guard didn't think to question him at all.
Well, he wouldn't, sir, would he? Not with his father dead and him being in a hurry.
Anything else missing?"
"No, sir. Just the burn box, sir, so far as he's got. And the card, like I said." Where are you going? Said Mary. Nigel was on his feet, tugging at the points of his waistcoat, while Brotherhood was loading things into his jacket pocket for a long journey on his own. His yellow cigarettes, his pen and notebook, his old German lighter.
What's a burn box? Mary said, close on panic. Where are you going? I'm talking, sit down.
Finally, Brotherhood remembered her and stared down at her where she sat. You wouldn't know, would you? He said. No, of course you wouldn't. You were grade 9. You never got high enough to find out. Explaining was a chore, but he managed it for old time's sake. A burn box is what it says. Little metal box. In this instance, it's a diplomatic pouch, steel-lined. Burns whatever is inside it as soon as you tell it to. It's where a station chief keeps his crown jewels.
So what's in it?
Nigel and Brotherhood exchanged glances. Fergus still had his eyes wide open.
What's in it?
She repeated, as a different and more elusive fear began to grip her. Oh, not much, said Brotherhood. Agents in place, all our checks, a few Poles, Hungarian or two, just about everything we have that's run from Vienna, or used to be. Who's Wentworth?
You asked, I don't know, a place. What else is in the burn box?
So it is. A place. She had lost him. Jack. Gone. Lost him as a lover, as a friend, as an authority. His face was her father's face when she took him the news of Sam's death. The love had gone out of him, and the last of his faith with it.
You knew, he said casually. He was halfway to the door, not even looking at her.
You bloody knew for years and years.
We all did, she thought.
But she hadn't the heart to say it to him, or for that matter, the interest. As if the bell had rung for the end of visiting time, Nigel also prepared to make his exit. Now, Mary, I'm leaving you Georgie and Fergus for company. They'll agree their cover with you and tell you how to play everything. They'll report to me all the time. From now on, so will you. Only to me. Do you understand? If you need to leave a message or anything like that, I'm Nigel. I'm head of secretariat. My PA is called Marcia. Don't talk to anybody else in the firm at all. I'm afraid that's an order. Even Jack, he added, meaning Jack particularly.
What else is in the burn box? She repeated.
Nothing, nothing at all. Routine stores. Don't worry yourself.
He came to her, and, emboldened by Brotherhood's intimacy with her, placed a hand awkwardly on her shoulder.
Listen, this needn't all be as bad as it sounds. We have to take precautions, naturally. We have to assume the worst and cover ourselves. But Jack does have a rather gothic way of looking at things sometimes. The less dramatic explanations are often a lot closer to home. Jack's not the only one with experience.
Chapter 6. A dark sea rain had enveloped Pym's England, and he strode in it warily. It was early evening, and he had been writing for longer than he had written in his whole life, and now he was empty and accessible and afraid. A foghorn sounded. One short, too long. A lighthouse or a ship. Pausing under a lamp, he again studied his watch. 110 minutes to go. 53 years gone. Bandstand empty. Bowling green awash. Shop windows still wearing their fly-blown yellow cellophane against the summer's sun. He was heading out of town. He had bought a plastic cape from Blandy, the haberdasher.
Good evening, Mr. Canterbury, sir. What can we be doing you for?
In the rain, its hood pattered round him like a tin roof. Inside its skirts, he carried his shopping for Miss Dubber. The bacon from Mr. Aitken.
Only mind and tell him he's to cut it on number 5. Give him half a chance, he'll make it thicker. And tell Mr. Cross, 3 of his tomatoes were rotten last week. Not just bad, rotten. If I don't have replacements, I'll never go to him again.
Pym had followed her instructions to the letter, though not with the ferocity she would have wished, for both Cross and Aitken were recipients of his secret subventions, and for years had been sending Miss Dubber bills for only half what she had spent.
From Farways, the travel agent, he had also obtained details of a senior citizen's tour of Italy, departing Gatwick in 6 days. I'll phone her cousin Melanie in Bognor, he thought. If I offer to pay for Melanie as well, Miss Dupper won't be able to refuse. 106 minutes. Only 4 gone. Cousin Melanie and Miss Dubber were forgotten. From countless pressing memories in his head, clamouring to be acknowledged, Pym selected instead Washington and the balloon. Of all the crazy ways we ever had of talking, really that balloon took the biscuit. You wanted a chat, I wouldn't meet you. I was running scared and had appointed you my un-person. But you wouldn't be put down. You never would. To humour me, you launched a miniature silver-coated gas balloon over the rooftops of Washington, D.C., 0.5 metre diameter. Sometimes Tom gets them free at the supermarkets. As we drove our separate cars on either side of town, you told me in German what a fool I was to do a garbo on you. Overmatched handsets that hopped like bedbugs between the frequencies and must have sent the listeners just as frantic. He was climbing the cliff path, past lighted bungalows cut from the gardens of a great house. I'll phone that doctor of hers and get him to persuade her that a break is what she needs. Or the vicar, she'd listen to him. Below him, the fairy lights of the amusement palace glowed like fat berries in the mist. Alongside them, he could make out the blue-white neons of the softer ice parlour. Penny, he thought. You'll never see me again unless it's my face in the newspaper. Penny belonged to his secret army of lovers, so secret she didn't know she was a member. 5 years ago, she was selling fish and chips from a porter cabin on the promenade and was in love with a leather boy called Bill, who beat her up. Until Pym ran the license number of Bill's motorbike across the firm computer and established he was married and had kids in Taunton. In a disguised hand, he sent the details to the local vicar, and a year later, Penny was married to a jolly Italian ice cream seller called Eugenio. But not tonight, she wasn't. Tonight, as Pym had approached her cafe for his regular 2 scoops of Cornish, she was head-to-head with a burly man in a trilby, whom Pym hadn't liked the look of one bit. It was just an ordinary traveller, he told himself, as a gust of wind filled his cape. A food salesman, a taxman. Who hunts alone these days, apart from Jack? And Jack it isn't, not by 30 years. It was the car, he thought. Those clean wings, the smart aerial, the pitch of his head as he listened.
Any callers, Miss D?
Said Pym, setting out his packages on the sideboard. Miss Dubber was sitting in the kitchen watching American soap opera, and having her one of the day. Toby sat in her lap.
They're so wicked, Mr. Canterbury, she said. There's not one among 'em we'd have here even for a night, would we, Toby? What's that tea you bought? I said Assam, you silly man. Take it back.
It is Assam, said Pym gently, stooping to show her. They've put it in a new packing and given you 3 pence off. Any callers while I was out?
Only the gas man for the meter.
The usual or someone new?
New, dear. They're all new these days.
Lightly kissing her cheek, he straightened her new shawl over her shoulders.
"Give yourself a nice stiff vodka, darling," she said.
But Pym declined, saying he must work. Regaining his room, he checked the papers on his desk. Stapler to handle of teacup, book matches to pencil, burn box aligned to desk leg. Ignore. Miss Dubber is no Mary. Shaving, he caught himself thinking of Rick. I saw your ghost, he thought. Not here, but in Vienna. Just as I used to see you in the flesh in Denver, Seattle, San Francisco, Washington. I saw your ghost in every shop window and autumn doorway, while I tried to clear my itchy back. You were wearing your camel hair coat and smoking the cigar you never drew on without frowning. Following me you were, and your blue eyes shadowed like a drowned man's, the pupils stuck against the upper lids to scare me. Where are you off to, old son? Where are those fine legs of yours taking you so late at night? Got a nice lady, have you? Someone who thinks the world of you? Come on, old son. You can tell your old man. Give us a hug. In London, you were lying on your deathbed, but I wouldn't go to you. I wouldn't know about you or talk about you. It was my way of mourning you. No, I will not. No, I will not, I used to say, each time my heel hit the cobble. So you came to me instead, to Vienna, and did a Wentworth on me. Every corner I turned, you were there, until I felt your loving stare like heat on the back I could never clear. Get off me, damn you, I whispered. What death was I wishing you? All of them, by turns. Die, I told you. Do it on the pavement, where everyone can see. Stop adoring me. Stop believing in me. Did you want money? Not any more. You had waived your claim to it in favour of the greatest claim of all. You wanted Magnus. You wanted my living spirit to enter your dying body and give you back the life I owed you. Having a bit of fun, are we, son? Old Poppy's crackerjack, I can see that for openers. What are you two hatching up together there? Come on, you can tell your old pal. Got some piece of business, have you? Putting a few bob in your pockets, are you? The way your old man taught you? 3 minutes. I always like to cut it fine. Pym wiped his face clean, and from an inside pocket drew his faithful copy of Grimmelshausen's Simplicissimus, bound in worn brown buckram and much travelled. He laid it ready on the desk, beside a pad of paper and a pencil, crossed the room, and knelt down in front of dear old Winston's wireless, spinning the Bakelite tuning dial until he had the wavelength. Volume down. Switch on. Wait. A man and a woman discussing in Czech the economics of a fruit cooperative. Discussion fades in mid-sentence. Time signal announces evening news. Stand by. Pym is calm, operational calm. But he is also a little bit transported. There is a serenity here that is not quite of this world. A hint of mystical affinity in his youthful, loving smile that says, "Hello there," to someone not quite of this earth. Of all those who have known him, other than this extraterrestrial stranger, perhaps only Miss Dubber has seen the same expression. Item 1, harangue against American imperialists following breakdown of latest round of arms talks. Sound of page turning. Signal for get ready. Noted. You are going to talk to me. I am thankful. I appreciate this gesture. Item 2 coming up. Presenter introduces college professor from Brno. Good evening, Professor, and how is the Czech Secret Service this evening? The professor speaks. A passage for translation. All nerves extended. The all of me at full stretch. First sentence. The talks have ended in deadlock. Ignore. In another bid, write it down. Slowly, don't rush. Patience again while we wait for the first numeral. Here it is. A 55-year-old welder from Pilsen. He switched off the wireless and, pad in hand, returned to his desk, eyes straight ahead of him. Opening his Grimmelshausen at page 55, he found 5 lines down without even counting, and on a fresh sheet of paper wrote out the first 10 letters of that line, then converted them to numerals, according to their position in the alphabet. Subtract without carrying. Don't reason, do it. He was adding again, still not carrying. He was converting numbers into letters. Don't reason. N-E-V. V-E-R. R-M-I. I-N-D. D-E-W. There's nothing here. It's gobbledygook. Tune in again at 10 and take a fresh reading. He was smiling. He was smiling like a saint when the agony is over. The tears were starting to his eyes. Let them. He was standing, holding the page in both hands above his head. He was weeping. He was laughing. He could scarcely read what he had written. Never mind. E. Weber. Love you always. Poppy. You cheeky sod, he whispered aloud, punching away more tears. Oh, Poppy! Oh, my!
"'Is anything wrong, Mr. Canterbury?'
Miss Dubber demanded sternly.
"'I came to take that vodka off you, Miss D.'
"'Vodka,' he explained. "'Vodka and something.' He was already mixing it.
"'You've only been upstairs an hour, Mr. Canterbury. We don't call that working, do we, Toby? No wonder the country's in a fuss.'
Pym's smile widened. "'What fuss is that?'
"'The football crowds, setting such a bad example to the foreigners. You'd never have let that happen, would you, Mr. Canterbury?'
"'Of course I wouldn't.' Warm orange juice from the bottle. Oh, glory! Chalky water from the tap. Where else would you find it? He sat with her for an hour, bubbling on about the charms of Naples, before he returned to his task of saving the country. How Rick won the peace, I'll never rightly know, Tom, but win it he did, overnight as usual. And none of us will ever have to worry again, son. There's plenty for everyone, and your old man's made it. In the zeal of the new prosperity, father and son took up the profession of country gentlemen. With victory in Europe still wet on the hoardings, the newly adolescent Pym bought himself a Harrods charcoal suit with its coveted long trousers, a black tie and a stiff white collar, all on the account, and steeled himself to have Sefton Boyd's promised fishhooks poked through his earlobes. Rick, meanwhile, in his immense maturity, acquired a 20-acre mansion in Ascot, with white fencing down the drive, and a row of tweed suits louder than the Admiral's, and a pair of mad red setters, and a pair of two-toned country shoes for walking them, and a pair of Purdy shotguns for his portrait with them, and a mile-long bar to while away his rustic evenings over bubbly and roulette, and a bronze bust of Teepee's head on a plinth in the hall, beside a larger one of his own. A platoon of displaced Poles was hauled in to staff the place. A new and classy mother wore high heels on the lawn, bawled at the servants, and gave Pym tips on the hygiene and diction of the upper classes. A Bentley appeared, and was not changed or hidden for several weeks, though a Pole with a grudge contrived to fill it with water from a hosepipe through a crack in the window and drench Rick's dignity when he opened the door next morning. Mr. Cudlove got a mulberry uniform and a cottage in the grounds, where Ollie grew geraniums, sang the Mikado, and painted the kitchen for his nerves. Livestock and a surly cowman supplied the character of a farm, for Rick had become a taxpayer, which I now know marked the summit of his heroic struggle for liquidity. "'It's a damn shame, Maxie,' he declared proudly to a Major Maxwell Cavendish, who had been brought in to advise on matters of the turf. "'Lord in heaven, if a man can't enjoy the fruits of his labours these days, what the devil did we fight the war for?' The Major, who wore a tinted monocle, said, "'What indeed?' and pursed his lips into a holly leaf. And Pym, agreeing wholeheartedly, topped up the Major's glass. Still waiting to be sent to school, he was going through a faceless period and would have topped up anything. Up in London, the court commandeered a pillared Reichskanzlei in Chester Street, staffed by a troop of lovelies who were changed as often as they wore out. A stuffed jockey in the Pym sporting colours, waving his little whip at them, photographs of Rick's never-wasers, and a tablet of honour commemorating the unfallen companies of the latest Rick T. Pym and Son empire, completed the Wall of Fame. Their names live in me for evermore, apparently, for it took me years of sworn statements to disown them, and I have most of them by heart to this day. The best celebrate the victory at arms that Rick by now was convinced he had obtained for us single-handed. The Alamein Sickness and Health Company, the Military and Permanent Pensions Fund, the Dunkirk Mutual and General, the TP Veteran Alliance Company, all seemingly unlimited, yet all satellites of the great Rick T. Pym and Son Holding Company, whose legal limitations as a receptacle of widow's mites were only gradually revealed. I have inquired, Tom. I have asked lawyers who know things. £100 of capital was enough to cover the lot. And we had books. Fancy! Winfield on tort. McGilvery on insurance. Snell on equity. Somebody else on Rome. Hoary old lawyers that they were always the first to disappear in adversity, and the first to come back smiling when the struggle was won. And beyond Chester Street lay the clubs, tucked like safe houses around the quieter corners of Mayfair, the Albany, the Burlington, the Regency, the Royalty, Their titles were nothing to the glories that awaited us inside. Do such places exist today? Not on the firm's expenses, Jack, that's for sure. And if so, then in a world already dedicated to pleasure, not austerity. They don't sell you illegal bets in the illegal sporting room. They don't have illegal mothers in low gowns who swear you'll break a lot of hearts one day. Or real live members of our beloved crazy gang leaning gloomily at the bar an hour before reducing us to tears of laughter in the stalls. Or jockeys scurrying around the snooker table that was too high for them. £100 a corner. And Magnus, why aren't you at school yet? And where's that bloody jigger? Or Mr. Cudlove, standing outside in his mulberry, reading Das Kapital against the Bentley steering wheel, while he waited to whisk us to our next important conference with some luckless gentleman or lady requiring the divine touch. Beyond the clubs again lay the pubs, Beadles at Maidenhead, the Sugar Island at Bray, the Clock here, the Goat there, the Bell at somewhere else, all with their silver grills and silver pianists and silver ladies at the bar. At one of them, Mr. Muspel was called a bloody profiteer by a small waiter he was insulting, and Pym contrived to leap in with a funny word in time to stop the fight. What the word was, I don't remember, but Mr. Muspel had once shown me a brass knuckle duster he liked to take to the races, and I know he had it with him that night. And I know the waiter's name was Billy Craft, and that he took me home to meet his underfed wife and children in their Bob Cratchit flat on the edge of Slough, and that Pym spent a jolly night with them and slept on a bony sofa under everybody's woolies. Because 15 years later, at a resources conference at head office, who should loom out of the crowd but this same Billy Craft, supremo of domestic surveillance section?
"I thought I'd rather follow them than feed them, sir," he said with a shy laugh, as he shook my hand about 50 times. "No disrespect to your father, mind. He was a great man, naturally." Pym, it turned out, had not been the only one to redress Mr. Muspole's ill behaviour. Rick had sent him a case of bubbly and a dozen pairs of nylons for Mrs. Craft. After the pubs, if we were lucky, came a dawn raid on Covent Garden for a nice touch of bacon and eggs to perk us up, before the 100-mile-an-hour dash to the stables, where the jockeys put on brown caps and jodhpurs, and became the Knights Templar Pym had always known they were, galloping the never-wasers down frosty runways marked by pine sprigs, till, in his loyal imagination, they rode off into the sky to win the Battle of Britain for us all over again. Sleep? I remember it just the once. We were driving to Torquay for a nice weekend's rest at the Imperial, where Rick had set up an illegal game of chemin de fer in a suite overlooking the sea. And it must have been one of those times when Mr. Cudlove had resigned, for suddenly we found ourselves in the middle of a moonlit cornfield that Rick, smelling strongly of the cares of office, had mistaken for the open road. Stretched side by side on the Bentley roof, father and son let the hot moon scorch their faces. "Are you all right?" Pym asked, meaning, "Are you liquid? Are we on our way to prison?" Rick gave Pym's hand a fierce squeeze. "Son, with you beside me and God sitting up there with his stars and the Bentley underneath us, I'm the most all-right fellow in the world." And he meant it, every word as ever. And his proudest day was going to be when Pym was at the Old Bailey, on the right side of the rails, wearing the full regalia of the Lord Chief Justice, handing down the sentences that had once been handed down to Rick, in the days we never owned to. "Father," said Pym, and stopped. "What is it, son? You can tell your old man." It's just that, well, if you can't pay the first term's boarding fees in advance, it's all right. I mean, I'll go to day school. I just think I ought to go somewhere." "Is that all you've got to say to me?" "It doesn't matter, really." "You've been reading my correspondence, haven't you?" "No, of course not." "Have you ever wanted for anything in your whole life?"
"Never."
"Well then," said Rick, and nearly broke Pym's neck with an armlock embrace.
"So where did the money come from, Sid?" I insist again and again. "Why did it ever end?"
Even today, in my incurable earnestness, I long to find a serious centre to the mayhem of these years. even if it is only the one great crime that lies, according to Balzac, behind every fortune. But Sid was never an objective chronicler. His bright eye mists over. A far smile lights his birdy little face as he takes a sip of his wet. Deep down, he still sees Rick as a great wandering river, of which each of us can only ever know the stretch that fate assigns to us. "Our big one was Dobsey," he recalls. "I'm not saying there wasn't others, Titch. There was. There was fine projects, many very visionary, very fantastic. But old Dobsey was our big one." With Sid, there must always be the big one. Like gamblers and actors, he lived for it all his life. Still does. But the Dobsey story, as he told it me that night over God knows how many wets, can serve as well as any, even if it left the darkest reaches unexplored. "For some time, Tidge," says Sid, while Meg gives us a drop more pie and turns the log fire up. "As the ebb and flow of war, Tidge, with God's help naturally, increasingly favours the Allies, your dad has been very concerned to find a new opening to suit those fantastic talents of his that we are all fully aware of, and rightly. By 1945, the shortages cannot be counted on to last forever. Shortages have become, let's face it, Titch, a risk business. With the hazards of peace upon us, your chocolate, nylons, dried fruit and petrol could flood the market in a day. The coming thing, Titch," says Sid, out of whom Rick's cadences ring like tunes I cannot shake off, "is your reconstruction. And your dad, with that brain of his he's got, is as keen as any other fine patriot to get his piece of it, which is only right. The snag, as ever, is to find the toehold, for not even Rick can corner the British property market without a penny piece of capital. And quite by accident," says Sid, "this toehold is provided through the unlikely agency of Mr. Muspole's sister, Flora. Well, you remember Flora?" "Of course I do. Flora is a good scout, a favourite with the jockeys on account of her stately breasts and the generous use she puts them to. But her true allegiance," Sid reminds me, "is pledged to a gentleman named Dobbs, who works for government. And one evening in Ascot over a glass, your dad being away at a conference at the time, Titch, Flora casually lets slip that her Dobsey is by vocation a city architect, and that he has landed this important job. 'What job is that, dear?' the court inquires politely. Flora falters. Long words are not her suit. 'Assessing the compensation,' she replies, quoting something she has not fully understood. 'Compensation for what, dear?' the court asks, pricking up its ears. 'For compensation never hurt anyone yet.' 'Bomb damage compensation,' says Flora, and glowers round her with growing uncertainty. 'It was a natural, Titch,' says Sid. 'Dobsey hops on his bicycle, slips round to a bombed house, picks up the blower to Whitehall. 'Dob's here,' he says. 'I'll have 20,000 quid's worth by Thursday, and no back chat.' And government pays up like a lady. Why?" Sid jabs my upper knee with his forefinger, Rick's gesture to the life. "Because Dobsey is impartial, Titch, and never you forget it." Dimly, I remember Dobsey, too, a whipped, untruthful little man, plastered on two glasses of bubbly. I remember being ordered to be nice to him, and when was Pim ever not? "Son, if Mr. Dobbs here asks you for something, if he wants that fine picture off the wall there, you give it to him, understand?" Pim eyed the picture of ships on a red sea in a different light from that day on, but Dobsey never asked for it. "With Flora's amazing secret on the table," Sid continues, "the wheels of commerce are flung into top gear. Rick is recalled from his conference. A meeting with Dobsey is arranged, a mutuality established. Both men are liberals, or masons, or the sons of great men. Both follow Arsenal, admire Joe Louis, think Noel Coward is a sissy, or share the same vision of men and women of all races marching arm in arm towards the one great heaven, which, let's face it, is big enough for all of us, whatever our colour or creed may be." This being one of Rick's set speeches, guaranteed to make him weep. Dobbs becomes an honorary member of the court, and within days introduces a loved colleague named Fox, who also likes to do good for mankind, and whose job is selecting building land for the post-war utopia
Thus the ripples of conspiracy multiply, find each other, and spread. The next to be blessed is Purse Loft. While pursuing a line of business in the Midlands, Purse has heard voices about a moribund friendly society that is sitting on a fortune, and makes inquiries. The chairman of the society, name of Higgs, destiny has decreed that all conspirators bear monosyllables, turns out to be a lifelong Baptist. So is Rick. He could never have got where he is today without it. The fortune derives from a family trust watched over by a country solicitor named Crabb, who went off to the war the moment it became available, leaving the trust to watch over itself as it thought best. As a Baptist, Higgs can fiddle no funds without Crabb to cover him. Rick secures Crabb's release from his regiment, whisks him by Bentley to Chester Street, where he can inspect the Wall of Fame, the law books and the lovelies, and thence to the dear old Albany, where he can have a nice talk and relax. Crabb turns out to be a cantankerous, idiotic little man who sticks out his elbow to take his drink, sir, wiggles his moustache to demonstrate his military shrewdness, and, after a few glasses, demands to know what you stripe-arsed civilians were doing while I was taking part in a certain contest, sir, risking one's neck amid shot and shell. At the Goat, some drinks later, however, he declares Rick to be the kind of chap he'd have liked to have as a commandant, and if need be, die for, which one damn nearly did a few times, but mum's the word. He even calls Rick Colonel, thus triggering a bizarre interlude in the great man's rise, for Rick is so taken with the rank that he decides to award it to himself in earnest, much as in later life he convinces himself he has been knighted secretly by the Duke of Edinburgh, and keeps a set of calling cards for those admitted to this confidence. Yet none of these added responsibilities holds up Rick's breathless waltz for 1 minute. All night long, all weekend, the house in Ascot receives a pageant of the great, the beautiful and the gullible. For Rick has become a collector of celebrities, as well as fools and horses. Test cricketers, jockeys, footballers, fashionable council, corrupt parliamentarians, glistening undersecretaries from helpful Whitehall ministries, Greek ship owners, Cockney hairdressers, unlisted maharajas, drunk magistrates, venal mayors, ruling princes of countries that have ceased to exist, prelates in suede boots and pectoral crosses, radio comedians, lady singers, aristocratic layabouts, war millionaires and film stars, all pass across our stage as the bemused beneficiaries of Rick's great vision. Lubricious bank managers and building society chairmen who have never danced before throw off their jackets, confess to barren lives and worship Rick, the giver of their sun and rain. Their wives receive unobtainable nylons, perfumes, petrol coupons, discreet abortions, fur coats, and if they are among the lucky ones, Rick himself. For everyone must have something. Everyone must be taken care of. Everyone must think the world of him. If they have savings, Rick will double them. If they like a flutter, Rick will get them better odds than the bookies. Slip me the cash, I'll see you right. Their children are passed to Pym for entertainment, exempted from national service by the intervention of dear old somebody, given gold watches, tickets to the cup final, red setter puppies, and, if they are ailing, the finest doctors to attend them. There was a time when such liberality dismayed the growing Pym and made him envious. Not today. Today I would call it no more than normal agent welfare. And among them, casual as cats, stalk the quiet men of the enlarged court. The men from Mr. Muspole's side, in broad-shouldered suits and brown pork-pie hats, calling themselves consultants and holding the telephone receiver to their ear, but not speaking into the mouthpiece. Who they were, how they came there, where they went. To this day, only the devil and Rick's ghost know. And Sid refuses point-blank to speak of them. Though with time I think I have put together a fair idea of what they did. They are the axemen of Rick's tragicomedy, now yielding at the knees and covered in false smiles, now posted like Shakespearean sentries round his stage, white-eyed in the gloom as they wait to disembowel him. And tiptoeing between this entire menagerie, as if between their legs, although he was already as tall as half of them,
I glimpse Pym again. Willing potboy. Blank page. Lord Chief Justice Designate, clipping their cigars and topping them all up. Pym, the credit to his old man. The diplomat in embryo, scurrying to every summons.
Here, Magnus, what have they done to you at that new school of yours? Poured fertilizer over you?
Here, Magnus, who cut your hair then?
Here, Magnus, tell us the one about the cabbie who puts his wife in the family way.
And Pym, the most compelling raconteur for his age and weight in all of Greater Ascot, obliges, smiles, and sidesteps between their anomalous colliding masses. And for relaxation, attends late-night classes in radical politics with Ollie and Mr. Cudlove in their cottage. At which it is heartily agreed over stolen canapes and cocoa that all men are brothers, but nothing against your dad. And though political doctrines are at root as meaningless to me today as they were to Pym then, I remember the simple humanity of our discussions, as we promised to mend the world's ills, and the truthful good-heartedness with which, as we went off to bed, we wished each other peace in the spirit of Joe Starlin, who, let's face it, Titch, and nothing against your dad ever, won the war for all these capitalist bastards. Court holidays are restored to the curriculum, for no man can give of his best without relaxation. San Moritz is off the map, following Rick's unsuccessful bid to buy the resort as a substitute for paying his bills there. But as compensation, now a favourite word, Rick and his advisers have espoused the south of France, sweeping down on Monty in the Train Bleu, banqueting the journey away in a brass and velvet dining car, only pausing to tip the froggy engine driver, who's a first-rate liberal, before dashing off to the casino, illicit currency at the ready. There, standing at Rick's shoulder in the Grand Salle, Pym can watch a year's school fees vanish in seconds, and nobody has learned a thing. If he prefers the bar, he can exchange views with a Major de Wildman of Lord Knew Who's army, who calls himself King Farouk's equerry, and claims to have a private telephone link to Cairo, so that he can report the winning numbers and take royal orders inspired by soothsayers on how to dissipate the wealth of Egypt. For our Mediterranean dawns, we have the somber march to the all-night pawnbroker on the waterfront, where Rick's platinum gold watch, gold cigarette case, gold swizzle stick, and gold cufflinks, with the Pym sporting colours, are sacrificed to the elusive god, liquidity. For our reflective afternoons, we have the tir au pigeon, at which the court, well lunched, lies face down in the butts, and pots away at luckless doves as they emerge from their tunnels, and start out into the blue sky, before crashing into the sea in a crumpled swirl. Then home again to London, with the bills all taken care of, which meant signed, and the concierges and head waiters seen right, which meant tipped lavishly with the last of our cash, to resume the ever-mounting cares of the Pym and Son Empire. For nothing may stand still. Too much is not enough, as Sid himself admits. No income is so sacrosanct that expenditure cannot exceed it. No expenditure is so great that more loans cannot be raised to hold the dam from breaking altogether. If the building boom is put temporarily out of service by the passing of an unfriendly building act, then Major Maxwell Cavendish has a plan that speaks deeply to Rick's sporting soul. It is to buy up everyone who has drawn a horse in the Irish sweep, and so win first, second and third prizes automatically. Mr. Muspole knows a derelict newspaper proprietor who has got in with a bad crowd and needs to sell out fast. Rick has ever seen himself as a shaper of the human mind. Purse Loft, the great lawyer, wants to buy 1,000 houses in Fulham. Rick knows a building society whose chairman has faith. Mr. Cudlove and Ollie are on intimate terms with a young dress designer who has acquired the donkey ride concession for the projected Festival of Britain. Rick likes nothing better than to give our English kids a break. And my godson, if anybody has earned it, they have. An amphibious motor car has been designed by Maury Washington's nephew. A national cricket pool is envisaged to complement the winter football pools. Purse has yet another scheme for contracting an Irish village.